Hey everybody, it's Matthew Isaacs, today's guest here. I just wanted to say before we get started that I hope everybody's staying safe. Please try to do your part in your communities. I know everything is tough right now, but I hope you guys are all trying to come together and be unified. We got to get rid of this racism stuff in the world and try to come together as a race, the human race. We're all one and we're all equal, so please come together and stay safe. And I hope you guys enjoy the podcast.
On again, and he's late again. Is this going to be the routine?
Guy. Why don't you send me a proper link next time?
I sent you a proper link.
A proper link. It was loading Aaron Gall's Choking Hazard 2020 podcast, aka Aaron Gall's competitive career.
Oh man, damn!
Hitting up Joe Rogan head on.
Yeah, one pebble at a time.
One sticking a stick right into the spokes of the wheel.
Yeah. Trying to get those little twigs. Those little twigs become branches, and then those branches become logs.
Building by bit. And then those logs get chopped down.
They get chopped down, yeah, by big corporations, and we all have nothing eventually.
So, Aaron, I see you cleaned up your basement for me.
I did clean up my basement. Thank you. I made sure that everything was all set up properly, and we were professional this time. And
I think it was cleaned up for me, to be honest.
Yeah.
I doubt that, Maddie. Hey. I can see you're in your bedroom. That's nice. You're okay with everybody seeing what your bedroom looks like?
Yeah, it's like a lot of people see it anyways. It's all good.
A lot of people see it. We need I asked last episode for an MTV Cribs tour of Pat Terrell's basement. We need a MTV Cribs tour of the Tony Isaacs basement. And
the Tony Isaacs basement,
is that finally complete after 10 years of construction?
It's looking very nice after 10 years of construction. It could be a little bit, you know, there's some little things that are not finalized yet, but it's looking real nice, especially like because it's taken so damn long to get it done. So
is it just like you guys don't have time to do it, or is it just all over the place?
My dad's just black, so you know, it takes him a little while to do longer. It takes him longer to do things, you know. It is what it is.
And for the record, that was Matthew Isaacs saying that based on what's going on in the world right now. I want to be
that was Matthew Isaacs saying that, exactly.
Extremely careful.
We're going to make sure that YouTube goes out on this one right away.
Yes. This is live and uncensored.
Yeah, we're gonna release the YouTube version first, and then we'll release the actual podcast so everybody gets
straight
context
demonetized,
of it.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I'll tell you what, like, so obviously we know who you are, but let's talk about who you are. So who is Maddie?
Maddie, in a few words, is a guy who likes to portray himself as a jiu-jitsu athlete, all around good person in the community, trying to just, you know, showcase my skills in jiu-jitsu and as well in other areas of life. I'm also trying to become an RMT. Who is Maddie? I guess I'm 22. I turned 22 this year in July. I was born in 1997. Two loving parents, can't complain. That's who I am, I guess.
All right, give us a little bit of a background. You've been training a long time. What were your first memories of jiu-jitsu, and what got you started in jiu-jitsu originally?
I have to say that was my dad. My dad has been doing a lot of combat sports ever since he was a young kid and growing up through the years. And when I was born, obviously he wanted to get me into doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu so I'm able to defend myself if I ever have to, stuff like that, as jiu-jitsu is great for self-defense. So I would say my dad was a big influence, obviously, trying to get me into jiu-jitsu from a young age. I started when I was about 7 or 8 years old. At first, I definitely, like, wasn't as passionate as I am now. There was a lot of, like, hard times growing up trying to compete and, like, get my gears going with jiu-jitsu. So I would have to say, like, the first, like, 3 or 4 years when I was, like, 7, 8, 9, 10, trying to get going in jiu-jitsu was a little bit tough. I think the turning point came when I was, like, 13 years old, and there was, like, an in-house tournament in New Jersey. And I just felt like preparing myself.
I'm gonna cut you off. I think we dropped Aaron. Okay, so I got an anchor off my back. Now we can do this podcast one-on-one finally.
Finally, we got rid of Aaron.
Yeah, and also I don't want to cut you off, but just for the people that are listening to this who don't know who your dad is, just give him a brief introduction. And also we'll probably like to have him on at some point as well.
Yeah, of course. My dad's probably one of the biggest advocates for BJJ in Ontario. His name's Tony Isaacs. You can go look him up. If you don't know who he is, you're not in jiu-jitsu. So I suggest you get into jiu-jitsu because he's definitely the biggest guy in Ontario for jiu-jitsu. Probably in Canada, to be honest. He got jiu-jitsu back up and running in Ontario, and he's the reason why we're doing the sport we love to do in Ontario. So go look him up, Tony Isaacs. He'll definitely be on the show at some point, I assume.
He will, for sure.
But that's my dad. And
we'll definitely get him on.
Yep. And then, Aaron, why did we lose you? What happened there?
Oh, sorry. No, I realized, like, I'm like, what's talking in the background down here? And it was my my television. I don't even know how it got turned on. And I was like, go up there. And I'm like, I didn't want to take the speakers with me. And because I would get feedback from the TV. So I'm like, oh, I'm just going to leave. But Maddie was in the middle of a great story, so I didn't want to say anything.
do you see what I have to put up here, Matt? Up with your Maddie? Like,
Aaron's always on and off. Like, yeah. What's going on, Aaron?
Okay. Let's get back on topic.
I don't know what it is. I just run the whole production. I just I do the advertising. I built the site. I build the recordings. Whatever.
You can't even keep your basement clean. You can't even turn the TV off to record an episode.
Apparently not.
Apparently. Let's get back on topic though. Matthew, you're sharing what was the turning point for you? Because you mentioned before you're doing jiu-jitsu. You started very young, about 7, 8 years old. You were doing it because, you know, your dad was kind of pushing you into it. But what really turned you on to, like, competing more? And
when I was younger, I would have to say, like, I love sports. I love to play sports. I played hockey since I was like 4 or 5 years old. And I hate losing in things. Like, I hate losing. I love to win. So I would say, like, the drive to win tried to force me back into the sport of jiu-jitsu. So it came, like, a time, 13, 14 years old, and there was, like, this tournament in New Jersey. And I being from Canada and, like, having a team go down from Canada, I wanted to win so bad and bring back, like, a gold medal and just have all the Canadian guys go down and just crush everybody down there. So I would have to say that was the turning point. I went down and I ended up winning gold in that tournament. And I think 11 or 10 out of the 11 people that went down from Canada, we sort of went down as a team. We all took gold and we took one silver back home to Canada that weekend. So that, I think that would be the turning point of when I really started to focus more on competition and focus more on getting better.
So when you look at, like, you're developing that mindset of competition, obviously from where you were, did you start getting that right after that point? So where do you kind of, like, what's the, like, the mental checklist that you have where it's like keeping your mindset in a spot where you're comfortable all the time to be in competition, whether it's in training or not?
I think training and competition is very, very different. Like, training, it's sort of like you don't really have the nerves and the jitters that you would in a competition setting. Like, I'm sure, Mike, you know what it's like being a competitor, having competed before.
No, Aaron, I don't. I haven't competed in years.
but you did compete on the show. I can't lie. And And for the first half of that match, you were looking a little shaky there, and then you pulled that all back together, you know?
I had to remember how to do jiu-jitsu for the first few minutes of that, actually.
Exactly. So the nerves of competition is a lot different from just training in the gym with your friends and everything like that. And for me personally, like, I don't think I could ever get over those nerves. And like, every match is like, there's always going to be nerves before the match. And when I step on the mat to go actually compete, all the nerves sort of like disappear. And then it's just, competition time, you know?
So what was, so you mentioned before that, that tournament down in New Jersey, was that your first experience with competing?
No, I've been competing since I was like 7 or 8 years old, since I started jiu-jitsu. I think that tournament in New Jersey was probably like where I really wanted to take competition seriously and then start to like really win. I hated losing when I was younger. I lost a lot. And like as I got older, like 13, 14, started to get a little bit more mature, I realized that I hated losing and I wanted to just win. And every time I step on the mat, I wanted to win, right?
So what changed for you mindset wise? So like you mentioned, like there is like a separation. I think all of us have competed to a certain degree where it's different than just, you know, rolling in the gym with your buddies. What have you learned over the years about yourself when it's come to competition? What's kind of like your mindset when it comes to competing and stepping on the competition scene?
Stepping on, like, just that being out there and like seeing the atmosphere of like being on the mat, it's like you have to just keep yourself composed, right? You can't like let the nerves get to you. You just gotta stay calm and just be ready to go out and not let it affect you when you're on the mat, right? If you let it affect you too much, it affects your ability to compete, and you don't perform like you want to. So I think just remaining calm is just jiu-jitsu, right? You have to like also take into the account that everybody loses in the sport. You have to adjust every time that when you do step out and you do lose, to take that experience as a learning experience and then go back to the gym, learn what you could have did better, and then going back out and doing better next time, right? So I think just not letting it get to you when you do lose, and then always trying to go out and do your best, I guess.
So the last tournament you were in was just recently, was the Abu Dhabi Nationals. So, and because we're probably not going to have any competitions for the rest of the year, like you're like the reigning champ.
Yeah.
So
I wouldn't say the reigning champ. There's a lot of good purple belts out there, a lot of good competitors, but yes, I did very well at that tournament.
You will go down in 2020 as an undefeated purple belt.
It is.
But yes. So it feels good to win. That's the second year in a row I won that tournament at Purple. I feel pretty good at that tournament. It just had a good vibe that day. I ended up winning my first match by footlock, and then I won my second match on points. Mike, you were in my corner for that match. You know how that one went. That was even, good showing in the corner right there. That was a perfect execution by the coach, I can't lie.
I think we need to find footage of that second match. We like to put it up at some point. And especially my visual coaching to you.
Yeah. Very, very
be acting out every step.
Yeah.
Well, what mat were you on? You're on two or three? Because three, I think I three was on, live.
I was in the middle mat. I'm not sure what mat that was, but the middle mat was live. I think mine was on like television or whatever in Abu Dhabi.
Okay, so it's
like
probably there. You probably just have to pull it up. I don't have somebody to pull footage for me, so we can't pull it up right now.
We'll pull footage and we'll roll it later. Yeah,
we'll roll. So now you're like, also a star in Abu Dhabi. Is that what you're saying?
Something like that. Star. Yeah, they like that. Yeah, they like me there. It's pretty cool.
You're kind of a big deal.
Yeah, kind of a big deal. Just a little bit.
So when you look at like kind of like you see where your mindset is and you see where you rank as far as like the competition goes right now, and you've had success in competitions. What do you think is like the next step for you, whether it's in your own development or things that you're working on, that's going to take you to that next level? Like, do you feel you're there, or are there things you're still working on? Like, I mean, don't give too much away, but
I don't think I'm ever really going to be there. You know, there's got to be like, you got to realize that the sport is always evolving. So there's always going to be new techniques to learn, new stuff to drill. And, but I think drilling is a big, big key in getting better. You always gotta, I think there's two things. It's the hard rolls and the drilling that sets aside the people that are really good from the people that are just average in the sport. I think hard rolling and drilling is the two key factors in becoming really good.
You need the pojada. Is that what you're saying?
You need the pojada. You can't go without the pojada. If you don't have pojada, you're not going to get better.
Is a key ingredient.
Key ingredient. But the drilling, there's also those days where you have to take your drilling into account. And you have to just like slow down and allow that to take play too, because you learn a lot when you slowed everything down.
So Maddie, are you doing any like exterior training at all? So like anything, like whether it's be strength and conditioning or just conditioning based, or like, are you watching your nutrition at all?
I don't really watch my, the only time I watch my nutrition is like 2 weeks before a competition where I would have to cut weight. Other than that, I'm eating McDonald's and Wendy's and all that other good shit, right? So
you're setting a good example for all the people listening to this podcast.
Technically a health
the high health. Matthew Isaac's high level nutrition,
high level diet
on display.
You know, so there is times where I do watch what I eat. I eat pretty good when a tournament's coming up. But other than that, like throughout the year where it's just like a regular week, I can't say my nutrition's the greatest. But also in regards to other training, shameless plug, Loose Strength Therapy. He gets all my strength and conditioning needs out of the way. He's the greatest with strength and conditioning. We always go to his gym and have like these late night sessions where we just work hard, get in strength and conditioning and get out, right? So I would have to say strength and conditioning is a big one as well. You just have to stay in shape. You can't get out of shape.
So how many days a week do you do that when you're in like competition training? Is it like 2 days a week? Do you add that in, or are you just kind of like,
it's usually one really hard strength and conditioning day a week. We try to go. But I also do like strength and conditioning stuff on my own. So I would say 2 or 3 days out of the week, we're doing some strength and conditioning stuff. I'm also trying to do some like field work outside with the sleds and stuff like that. So hopefully that helps. We're just seeing how it goes in the quarantine times. So, if it helps, it helps over the summer. Hopefully we get better with that as well.
The big question that everybody wants to know is, Maddie, do you even lift?
I hate lifting. I hate lifting. It's the worst thing ever. I feel like when I lift the next day, I can't feel my legs. I don't want to move. Like, going upstairs, when I was in school and I would do lifting, I would never go upstairs. I would take the elevator because, like, going upstairs hurts. And after you do legs, bro, my legs, no. I'm a guard guy. I don't need my legs.
Yes.
You need your legs.
You need your legs. This will be an important thing for you to add to your toolkit, being able to leg press somebody off of you.
Yeah, balloon sweeps.
You mentioned Loose Strength. That's another James Liu, for those who are listening. He's a therapist out in the Scarborough area. That's another person I'd like to have on as well at some point. You mentioned that he's an RMT, and that's a registered massage therapist. What got you initially interested in becoming a massage therapist? Was it James Liu himself? Was it other things? What was the kind of that connection for you?
What got me like the most into becoming an RMT, I didn't really know what I wanted to do after high school. As a lot of people don't know as well. And I sort of like, I obviously I love to play sports. When I was younger, I played a lot of sports. So I wanted to sort of stay in the field of athletes and athletics. And I sort of started looking at like therapies and way to help athletes, because when you see like your friends on your team get injured, it's like, oh, like I wish I could help you, but like you just gotta like heal and rest up, right? So I looked at a whole bunch of different ways to help, and massage therapy is like a very underlooked, and it, I think it's starting to grow now, but before when I was younger, massage therapy was like unheard of to help people, right? So I feel massage therapy is a great way to rehab your body and get back to doing the sports you love. So I think just that, like helping my teammates when they're injured and stuff like that, I think that's what pushed me sort of towards massage therapy and trying to become a massage therapist.
Very nice. So when you, like, obviously with the lockdown and all that kind of stuff, like, have you kind of established like a plan way forward? Obviously, even with your RMT, like what the next step is, or are you just kind of like waiting on the wings to see where everybody goes and how their process is going to work, or you just, you have an idea already?
Yeah, I'm sort of just trying to like wait and see how everything goes. Obviously still training a little bit, but it's sort of weird times, you know, like you can't really do anything or go really anywhere, right? So for the meantime, I mean, competitions are on hold. Some of my friends, they've already become RMTs. They're sort of not really working out in the field. You can't really see clients or anything like that. So it's just sort of all on hold, and just waiting to see how everything plays out, really.
And you mentioned, what are some of like the parallels, or I guess what would be important for jiu-jitsu practitioners to know about, you know, massage therapy, and, you know, what are some common injuries that you've seen? Like all three of us have been injured to a certain extent doing jiu-jitsu, where we've been, you know, nicked up, sprained this, scraped this. What are some of the common things that you see as like a practitioner of that?
In my non-professional opinion, I think you see a lot of like muscle strains, especially with a lot of like push-pull actions in jiu-jitsu. You're pulling a lot, you're pushing a lot. So if your body's in a compromised position, I feel like you're going to strain your body in a certain way. And just like when you strain your body, when you strain any muscle in your body, it causes a lot of inflammation and stuff like that. So I feel massage therapy in a way can help with a lot of the muscle strains that you obtain and a lot of the injuries that you obtain from jiu-jitsu. There's a lot of joint mobilizations that can help the joint capsules as well. It's just like so different and not the same as any other therapy, right?
So obviously, because we've rolled before and we talk about people getting muscle strains and all that kind of stuff, but I've seen your feet bend in weird spots that normal people don't have. So, and that's a gift, honestly. So like how did you like get these flexible feet, and like, how do you just like, is it just something that comes naturally? You like playing that foot game, I know, and you take risks with your feet. So like, do you just feel confident you're never going to get foot locked, or like what's going on?
Aaron's also angry that he can't toe hold you.
Yeah, it's hard to toe hold me after, like, I don't know, it's I think it's just because I like to play that foot game, but I guess you build up a not an immunity, but like sort of like a tolerance to foot locks when you play that game a lot, and you just sometimes you get your foot stretched, right, in training, and mm-hmm. your foot just like extends its range of motion in a way, like you just build up a tolerance to foot locks over time if you get your foot stretched, and I think it's just having my foot stretched before, I just know what it feels like, and I know where to move in the direction of how not to get foot locked, I guess.
I don't remember who it was, but I think it happened like last year's Pans, or like the guy got toe hold. And basically, his foot's like in shambles.
I think that was a Homolo Bahal. Was it a yeah, few like, years at Worlds?
I think it was, actually.
Like it was a couple years ago. Pans, yeah.
It was at exactly. Pans, yes.
And, like, he gets toe-hold, and the foot is just in shambles, and he's just like, I'm not tapping. I was like, it's in shambles, man. Like, it's destroyed. There's nothing to stand on.
I think that's just the will to win with that guy. He did not want to lose. I think he was winning that match too. I'm not sure who he was fighting. I think it was Patrick Gaudio. I think it might have been Patrick Gaudio versus Homolo Bahal. I'm not sure if it was Worlds or Pans, but I remember seeing his foot, and it was not how it was supposed to be.
Did you see Craig Jones and Vinny recently?
I missed it. I did not see that.
Oh,
when was
so, you'll have to that see just, that.
That was like Submission Underground. So that was like a couple. I want to say like 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, and basically Craig Jones put him in a heel hook, and Vinny's like, no, not tapping, and he reaped it. The fucking ankle turned around, basically, like it just broke apart
like 180 right? degrees. Think of your ankle degrees. Just spinning.
Like, oh, and then man. Craig's looking at him, he's like, I'm sorry. And Vinny's just like, it's messed up anyways, just keep going. And I think the ref stopped it. I'd have to, don't quote me on that. Yeah, you gotta go back and watch that fight.
I the footlock game, the 50, I have to say 50-50 is probably my favorite position, other than like a dominant position like the back or something like that. But 50-50 is just like, I love playing that full out game. So it is what it is. You know, if you get your foot stretched, it's just sometimes it's how it goes.
Yeah. Well, you hit up that guy at Abu Dhabi 20 seconds in, like it was good.
Yeah.
Quick.
I think it was in 26 seconds or something with, yeah. Just double pull foot lock.
Yeah,
that's how it went.
It was a good match. Yeah, unfortunate because the guy was on my team, but
sorry, Josh. You should have warned him, man. You should have warned him.
I told him, but oh well, no big deal.
Watch your foot. Too late.
I was in the stands. I couldn't say anything.
So let's. Another thing I wanted to ask you as well is you being a lighter guy doing jiu-jitsu, not lifting. Being a smaller man in a contact
small human.
He's tall, but like doesn't have a ton of mass on his body. But we'll say for people that are lighter and are doing jiu-jitsu, what is some advice that you would give to them? Like, you know, just either mindset wise or just like how to structure training, how to train with people that are a lot bigger and stronger than them.
A word of advice would be, I guess, believe in your technique, because technique lands almost every time. There is that odd time where a guy is really strong and he does get a dominant position on you and you can't get back because he is stronger, right? But you have to believe in your technique, I feel, because the technique will win almost every time. When I was younger a lot, I would when I was 13, 14, 15 years old, I would a lot of the times go to the adult classes and have to roll with some of the bigger dudes. And back then I would just get smashed because like the game just, I was just trying to take to the game and learn it back then. And I would just get obliterated by these bigger guys, obviously, because back then I was only probably like 110 pounds. So back then I would just get smashed. And I think just over time training with these bigger guys coming up, through age and learning, just allowed me to learn how to deal with bigger people. And then when I got to 19, 18, 19, 20 years old, I've gone through it all. So, I think I just know how to deal with, the bigger people and, just know how to put myself in non-compromising positions with bigger people.
So when you look at like, training for like I don't even know what I'm talking about right now. I'm like looking at it. I'm like,
this is live, Aaron. We'll do it live. We'll do it live.
I'm looking at my notes. I'm like, oh, what am I reading? But Michael,
we gonna go turn off your TV or you gonna turn off your TV again?
No,
I have to turn it back on again.
I know. I do have a question though. So I want to know why you're not able to bolo Mike yet, because you've been working on this forever and you still can't pull it off. So,
I think Mike's scared of the bolo. He keeps running from it every time I try to do it on him.
That's it.
He's just running every time, and I can't bolo a guy that doesn't want to fight. So, so I think he's just running away from it every time.
I would agree. Mike's kind of a scared guy. He runs away a lot.
I think what Maddie is trying to say is all these years of me training with him, I have him so psychologically beaten down that he's, when we slap hands and we bump and roll, he's already lost.
And for people who don't know what the bolo is, can you just explain your version of the bolo so they have an understanding of what that means?
The Baron Bolo is like, there's a whole bunch of different variations of the Baron Bolo. You can go look it up on YouTube and stuff like that. But the Baron Bolo is, I guess, when you are in guard, whether it be like Delhi Hiva guard or anything like that, and you sort of invert your body and sort of end up on the guy's back later. You sort of go around his body and take his back with the Delhi Hiva. But it's a lot of inverting, a lot of grip switching, a lot of footwork, sort of.
So you're saying I can do it.
You could if you practiced it. You could, yeah.
No, he's not saying that, Aaron. He's not saying that at all.
I lied,
Aaron. It's not my style. I don't like inverting.
You're a top guy. You're probably not gonna get it.
That's true.
It's so funny. My dad always is like, he's got no gut. Like Matt's got no gut, so he inverts and he folds in half. It's so easy for him to do. Like my dad's like, I'm never gonna be able to bolo because my gut's so big. Like I can't invert like he can.
Oh, Tony. Tony's just not meant to do that. That's it.
Yeah, his
body's not structured that way.
Yeah. I don't think he has the neck and the shoulders and the anatomy for a move like that at this point.
That's the thing. Like with the bolo, it's just like how many people invert and you're on your back of your neck. And so obviously like I have neck problems enough, right? So that's the one thing I've noticed with a lot of guys who used to bolo a lot as they get older. They're like, I don't do it anymore because of my neck bothering me so much. So being on their back, inverted, all that kind of stuff. So they kind of change the way they enter it. So they're not on their neck anymore. And then it's not bolo anymore. So
I can imagine the Meow Brothers are going to have a lot of body problems later in their lives. Like they're very flexible and stuff, but they invert so easily. And it's just like, how do you not hurt when you do that? Like, it's crazy.
Wasn't it at Abu Dhabi, basically his leg, which brother was it? Sorry, I don't even remember.
I believe it was Ty Rutulo. He had him in a knee bar, and you can basically see, like, this is
Meow's
leg. Meow's knee, and then this is straight, and then his knee was, like, down here.
Yeah.
For the people that are watching us on video.
Hyperextended way beyond where an ACL would normally be, which I don't believe he has an ACL anymore. Like
he's very flexible. I can imagine like he's somehow double jointed in his knee. I don't even know, but it was very gruesome, that knee bar.
You'd be a very interesting massage therapy case study. Now, one thing I want to go over with you is we talk about competition a lot, but let's have some fun right now, like some funny competition stories. It could be, you know, you on the way to a tournament with people such as myself and the other people. I think you know the story that I may be getting at where young Matthew Isaacs offers some advice.
Yeah. There's so many stories of over the years, man, I tell you. And like from when I was younger to even now, like traveling to tournaments and stuff, it's just like so many experiences. And so like I'm so grateful for all the people I've met and all the experience I've had. I remember one time we were going to Ottawa, and I think it was me, you in the car. What was it? Me, you, Max,
and your dad.
And my dad.
And your dad
in the car. And I think we had to stop somewhere. Where did we have to stop?
I think it was at a mechanic, I believe.
At a mechanic or something. I think we had to, like, get something done or, like, change the tires on my dad's car or something like that before we had to go. And we were in the mechanic shop. And, yeah, that was that. I don't know if you want to tell the story. I think you should
tell the story, man. I can't go that far.
I think telling it the story from a guy who seems – because I was serious during the time when I don't know. I was really serious. So you found it very funny. I think you should tell the story.
I'll set the stage. This way, you were probably 13, 14 at the time. I don't think you were much older than that. So it was the four of us. We were waiting for Tony's tires to be changed so that we can be on our way to Ottawa to ref and compete. And, you know, as a father who I have a small child as well, and I'll be talking to him one day about, you know, like advice, maybe advice with, you know, women, for example, which is what your dad was trying to offer.
I just want to make sure as we're telling this story, I don't want to make sure we don't get anybody in trouble. So
no, we're good with this story.
We're good with this. We're not this
okay.
I think the only one who might be in trouble is Maddie. But
yeah, okay, all right. No problem.
So all you know, ahead. Tony's talking to his son. He's like, you know, they're talking about girls and like, you know, what, you know, how you should treat a girl. And so Tony asks Maddie, he's like, you know, what's my number one rule when it comes to women? And then Maddie, in the middle of the mechanic shop with about 20 or 30 dudes there, just yells out, always wear a condom.
And I was really serious at the time.
And I dropped to the ground laughing to the point where I was asked to leave by the receptionist.
Max was laughing so hard. Shout out Max Mazira.
Yeah.
He was laughing so hard he fell out the door of the mechanic shop. Like he was just like laughing so hard he was outside already, and then you were laughing so hard inside the lady asked you to leave the mechanic shop because it was so loud.
And then I think the best part I think was your dad's reaction. He's like, "No, you idiot! He's, you know, be nice, you know, be nice to them, treat them well." He's like, "Where did you learn this stuff? What is wrong with you?" Like he's probably a little bit embarrassed. He's like, I never told my 12-year-old to.
It's not bad education, though. That was good education.
It's important, but, like, I mean.
To be honest, I didn't know what he was getting. I thought he wanted, like, a real answer. Like, that was my real answer. Like, obviously, be nice. Like, be nice is, like, just regular morals, I guess. But I thought he wanted an answer to the number one rule question. But, you know, it's all the same thing, I guess.
It's all about the things that you learn on the road at jiu-jitsu tournaments growing up.
Yeah, I had so many good memories of going to Ottawa. Ottawa's, like, one of the funnest tournaments to go to over the course of the years, just with, like, from the people who run it to the travel stories and, like, going in the hotels and staying with your team. I remember we always used to go stay with Amir Yafawi down at Combat Arts. He there was always good times with him in the hotels. Shout out Amir. Yeah, man, just so many good stories out over the years of traveling and competing and stuff. Always traveling with the Gringos. Shout out Gringo and Action Reaction. Always good stories everywhere, all around.
So when you look at, like, special like competition moments, like, what's one competition moment that's really stuck out to you on the competition floor, or, you know, as a spectator, what in your own experiences, what would you say that is?
As a spectator, just being in that world's in the Walter Pyramid, just like being there for worlds, watching worlds. I think as a spectator, that's just like being in that building every year. So sad I couldn't be there this year because of what's going on, but being there every year since I was 19 years old, just like getting to watch everything that's going on, all the atmosphere and everything in that building, it's just so amazing. So I would have to say, like, just every year at Worlds, being a spectator, watching that, that's just a great moment for me. As a competitor, I would just count every time that I get to step on the podium in the first place spot, I guess. I don't know. There isn't really one moment. It's just like all the moments getting to compete, I would have to say is a great time. I would have to say the best competition would be, I would say in jiu-jitsu, I would have to say Pan Nogi in 2015, I think. I took silver. That was my best showing at an international tournament. And I would have to say my favorite tournament that I ever competed in was probably my grade 11 regional championships for wrestling. I think I fought 6 matches that day. I won 5 out of the 6, and then I got second. I finished second in the tournament, and then I was challenged for my spot to go to OFSA, which is the Ontario championship for high school. And I won my challenge match. Like, it was such a weird position. It was such a crazy scramble. And I was sort of taken down with an ankle pick, and he walked sort of into a triangle. But in the rules in wrestling, you can't lock your legs into a triangle. So I just pinched my knees together. And I sort of had like a triangle on the guy in a wrestling match. And I used the triangle to sweep him. And I swept him, came on top, and I pinned him. And I won the match. And like, my whole team went crazy in the corner. And that was to go to OFSA. So it was like a big match throughout the day. There wasn't very many challenge matches. So sort of everybody was watching. And it just felt like a great moment for my team. My dad was there. He was in my corner. So it was just I think that was my best tournament that I ever competed in. For wrestling or jiu-jitsu.
So how, like you said, challenge match. So just like, cause I don't really understand it. Like, how does it work in wrestling? So like do you have a place already set and then somebody challenged to take that spot from you, or how did it work?
Yeah. So the way it works in wrestling, I'm not sure if it's the same in the States, but in Ontario wrestling for ROPSA, the way they did it was this is when I was in high school. I don't know if it's the same now, but, I'm 5 years out of high school. Right. So it's,
Rules have changed. I have no idea.
Exactly. So, but when I was in high school, the way it worked was the bracket was made. You fought the whole bracket. So I had 6 matches. I lost in the finals. So I placed second, but I never fought the third place competitor. So gotcha. Only the top 2 people go from my region, which was ROPSA, Region Appeal. Only the top 2 athletes get to go to OFSA. So I finished second. The guy that I lost to finished first. He beat the third place guy.
Gotcha.
So I never fought the third place guy. So because of that, he was able to challenge me for my spot to go to OFSA. He wasn't able to challenge me for the silver medal. I already won that. But he was able to challenge me for my place to go to OFSA. And that's the reason for the challenge match, is to give the third place guy an opportunity to fight the second place guy that he never got.
Okay, gotcha. That makes sense. Okay, that's actually not a bad idea.
Yeah, so, I think that tournament, Grade 11 ROPSA, was probably my favorite competition moment. Unfortunately, OFSA was in Brampton that year. Obviously, was grateful to go to OFSA, but I love traveling with my team. So, having it be in Brampton, I was just staying at home. I wasn't really with the team in the hotel, you know. But obviously, OFSA is a privilege to go to every year in high school. So if you ever get the opportunity, I suggest you take that opportunity.
Yeah, I'm way out of there, buddy.
Aaron's about 25 years old.
For all the high school kids, you know?
It's been a while.
You guys are out of there, but
for all the Aaron's high school about 25 kids, years out of high school.
I'll keep that in mind for the boys.
It's funny you mention that, because a lot of times, like, there's a lot – you have a lot of extensive jiu-jitsu experience, but, like, you've also – you know, you've wrestled a lot as well, especially in high school.
Yeah, I took – I obviously been training jiu-jitsu since I was 7. So when I got to high school, when I got to, like, 11 or 12 years old – grade 9 is 12 years old, right? So when I got to 12 years old, I sort of stopped doing jiu-jitsu down to like one day a week, and I focused on wrestling for all 4 years of high school. So I wasn't really focusing on jiu-jitsu during that time, and was sort of focused on wrestling because I wanted to be able to do the best I could in high school wrestling, right?
Yeah.
So let me ask you this, because you were competing in jiu-jitsu, you competed in wrestling, and you always hear debate, and I just want to hear your perspective on it more than anything, is like wrestling is the hardest sport in the world, right? Would you kind of take that sentiment, especially because you've trained both and you competed in both, saying that wrestling is harder than jiu-jitsu, or would you say it's vice versa, or you say they're on the same even playing field? Where do you kind of stand on that?
There are two different sports. I would say wrestling is a lot of the jiu-jitsu people might hate me for this, but I think wrestling is a lot harder than jiu-jitsu. I think it's a lot harder than jiu-jitsu. That's coming from a guy who's been doing jiu-jitsu since I was so young, right? So when I did high school wrestling, it was just like, I think the grind of wrestling is a lot more difficult than the grind of jiu-jitsu. There's a lot more grips and stuff in jiu-jitsu as well, but wrestling is just that mental toughness that you gain from just the training, the tournaments, the matches. You got to win sometimes like 7-8 matches in a day to get even place in a wrestling tournament, right? So It's the same goes for jiu-jitsu as well, but wrestling matches are just a tough grind all the whole match, and you might have to do that 6 times a day. So
I think the rules are different, the place is different, okay. No, I just wanted your take on it more than
anything. Yeah, jiu-jitsu is definitely like a different sport, but I feel wrestling is a lot more tougher mentally sport than jiu-jitsu is.
You think that kind of helped you with your competition mindset as well, like having that wrestling background?
Yeah, I would say so. Wrestling in high school helped my jiu-jitsu. I wouldn't say my jiu-jitsu, maybe a little bit, but I think my jiu-jitsu helped a little bit with my wrestling. It sort of gave me a competition base already, but I would say my wrestling helped my jiu-jitsu way more than the other way around.
Yeah.
What would you say that your, like, we're talking about like maybe wrestling practices and competitions are like a lot more mentally taxing. What would you like to change? So like, let's say you're running a class or you're running a competition team. What would be like your ideal, like, this is how we're going to train, this is how we're going to do things. Like, how would you split things up?
To be honest, I would dedicate like a training session to rolling. Like I wouldn't even do, because a lot of classes are like you drill, you start up with a warm-up, you drill, you go over the techniques, and then at the end of class you roll, right? That's like sort of your standard jiu-jitsu class, I guess. For if you're a competitor, I recommend you just have a class where you warm up. You get into like sort of like a movement sort of mode where you're getting warm and stuff, and then you go straight into rolling. You go straight into scenarios. You go straight into rolling. I think if you want to do technique and drill and stuff, I think that should be a completely separate, dedicated class. Like, I think you should roll one class really hard, and then you should drill separately in another class. I think that's how it should be for competition athletes, right? But everybody's got their take on it. I don't know if you guys might have a different take on it, like, but that's I think how it should be run, right?
Aaron, do you have a perspective on this?
I think it's for younger athletes, absolutely. I think that's a good perspective. The way to look at it is like having your, because again, you're competing to roll, and you need more practice, and more rolling gets you more practice every single time, and you can maximize that amount of time in there. That's what you need, right? And then you solely base it into drilling on other days. I think it's perfect, so that way it's recovery. With older athletes, though, like yourself and me, I don't think hard days, you have to kind of keep them few and far between, right? Because I would say you have like maybe one of those once every 2 weeks where it's basically having a hard rolling based sessions or the whole class of an hour, let's call it 10 rounds at 6 minutes, whatever, right? And then you're focusing on your technique, and then you have your light rolls, but more like argumented situation drills, right? So it was just staying in those positions and fight from those positions only. That's my take on it, especially with older athletes, because you can't be rolling hard all the time. Whereas, and again, I think it is vice versa, right? I think it's a good complementary, whereas, okay, if you're off a competition, now there's a way to kind of peak yourself down, right? Because obviously during competition, you want to be peaking at the right moment. And then if you go right back into that type of training right away, you're just going to burn the body out eventually. So I would say let's bring it back down and bring it into, again, the more traditional style for maybe a week, right? Like, okay, do technique, then you do your warm up, your roll, and have that, and then you go back into more situational, and then you, as you start your training to get ready for the next competition, then you're going into your hard days 2 to 3 days a week, and then having your technique based days.
That's my thing. Yeah, there's you always have, it's perspective of the athlete, right? So if you're a 19, 20-year-old athlete, or if you're a 30-year-old athlete, or if you're not an athlete at all and you're just doing it recreationally, there's always different like ways to do jiu-jitsu. You have to make it so it's based on yourself and your own goals, right? So recommend it if you're a competition athlete, you definitely have to get those roles in. If you're a recreational person who's trying to learn how to defend themselves, I definitely recommend you go through the motions, you do the techniques, you break down each technique so you get it perfectly, and you don't have to think about it when you have to do it out in the street per se, or anything like that. You just bang it off just like so easy because you've done the technique, right?
I think you mentioned something that's very important, because everybody has different goals when it comes to jiu-jitsu. Like, some people are gonna, you know, want to be a world champion. Some people are just want to do something, you know, just to, you know, lose weight, learn how to defend themselves. A variety of different classes for each individual. I guess one of the last questions I want to ask you is, if there's somebody listening to this podcast and they're thinking about trying jiu-jitsu, what would your advice be to them?
My advice would be jiu-jitsu could possibly be for everybody. Jiu-jitsu, it has a special way of adapting how you use it and adapting how you train it to be able to have that effect on everyone. Like, whether you're a very large person or whether you're a very small person, whether you're a girl or whether you're a boy, it shouldn't matter what kind of person you are. Jiu-jitsu can be for everybody. And I think that just giving it a shot and trying it, whether you want to be a world champion, there can be female world champions, there can be male world champions. Or if you just want to do it recreationally to lose weight, to get in shape, I feel jiu-jitsu can be for everybody. And it's a great way to get in shape and lose weight, but it's also a great way to put into a sport and have a world champion there and be one of the best competitive athletes in the world.
Very nice. Aaron, do you have anything else you want to add?
Yes, I actually have a two-part question. So,
two-part. Okay.
I have a two-part question. Yes. So, Matt, what is kind of like the next step for yourself? What's the next goal that you're working on? Obviously, when everything kind of gets lifted up, and then do Bolo's work in the street.
You know what my answer is going to be to that. I'll start with the first one, because the second one I'm gonna you know. So the first question, I would definitely say for myself, the way I see it, especially right now, I'm just trying to stay training. I recommend everybody tries to stay in shape at some degree, because being at home in your house, like quarantine with your family, can get very very, like, you guys can butt heads a lot. So jiu-jitsu is a great way to relieve some stress, even just getting outside and going for a walk or something, you know. Just try to stay in shape, do some active stuff. But I'm just trying to stay in shape, move around. Me and my dad roll a lot in the basement. We got that basement base, so we can train in the basement. So I'm just trying to stay active, stay in shape, and can't wait for everything to come back to normal. I know the world's sort of a mess right now, and everybody's gonna just like band together and stay unified, and I hope when we come back the community can come together and we can all do something fun, get back to the tournaments and everything, right? Does Bolos work in the street? My take is going to be, yes, Bolos work in the street, but you obviously have to be mindful of everything else that goes on the street. There's weapons, there's punches, there's kicks, there's everything. So I recommend if, like, you get in a street fight, you better defend yourself. If you're going to do a Baron Bolo in the street, you better defend yourself. And make sure, like, if you do it, it better work.
So you would say, don't screw this up.
Yeah.
So one move you don't want to screw up.
Yeah, that. Yeah. So I recommend you do something else to make sure that you defend yourself better. But if you are very confident in yourself that your Baron Bolo is going to work, by all means, go take the guy down, Baron Bolo, you know? But you better defend yourself before you try that. You know what I'm saying?
What would Professor Dan say to that?
Professor Dan would say, Matt, you're crazy. Matt, why are you doing Baron Bolos in the street? He'd be like, why don't you just, like, take him down and stay on top? Why you got to Baron Bolo him? That's I could hear him saying all of that right now. I could just, yeah.
I wonder what Enzo Gracie would say to that.
I wonder. Yeah,
I wonder what a lot of people would say to that. But
I think that's going to be like my closing line on a lot of these podcasts now.
Does Baron Bolo work in the street?
Yeah.
Tune in next week.
Tune in next week to see who else has a take on Baron Bolo in the street.
I think that's my official closing line. So Baron Bolo work.
Baron Bolos can work in the street if you know what you're doing, but if you don't know what you're doing, don't do it.
So far we have a checklist. Baron Bolo in the street, one.
Yeah, that's Matty Isaac, so we'll put that up there.
Doing other techniques, zero.
Doing other techniques, zero.
Awesome. Well, Matty, I really want to appreciate the time that you took today to kind of hang out with us and go over kind of like your experiences and obviously everything that you've kind of gone through in your very young jiu-jitsu career, but it's also vast and experience, right? So I really look forward to seeing in the future. Obviously we'll get back on the mats eventually, but thanks a lot again for coming on the show. We really do appreciate it. I wish you and all the best to your family, and we'll see each other soon.
I appreciate it. Thank you guys for having me. It was great talking with you guys for however long we've been on here, but it's been great talking to you guys. Hopefully we can train soon. Mike, you're looking a little scruffy there. I see you got to trim up that beard and stuff, you know. I don't want to come back to jiu-jitsu and you're overweight too. You better be on in shape. Yeah. So when I try to Baron Bolo you, I don't get squashed and stuff. You too, Aaron, don't think you're getting away from this.
It doesn't matter if I'm 120 or 220. You're still getting squashed. But Matty, before I let you go, you've been training a long time. I've known you a really long time. You evolve your evolution as, you know, a person and as a practitioner. You've evolved so much. But before I let you go, do you have any sponsors that you want to shout out as well? The floor is yours before we sign off tonight.
At the moment, I would have to say thank you to Loose Strength Therapy for always being there for me, helping me out. He's always there with everything as my massage therapy needs, my strength and conditioning needs. He was there a lot when I hurt my MCL last year. So shout out to that guy. He's the best in the business for jiu-jitsu. Go hit him up. Thank you to King's Kimonos and Fighters Market. You guys outfit me every tournament. So thank you guys for all the gis and everything. And thank you for the support. I would have to say that's it for the moment. Anybody need any sponsorships, you can hit me up. And thank everybody for the support.
We need sponsorships too, so don't hog them all.
Exactly.
Remember the tens and tens of dollars that we're going to be making on this podcast, Aaron. Hey. That day one.
We're working on it.
A1 podcast. I love being one of the original guests on this podcast. So when this podcast is huge, I can say I was one of the first, you know?
Oh, yeah. And then we'll have you back for sure.
100%. We're going to have you back on again.
Boa.
When everything lifts off. All right.
When we're all lifted off.
This is right. Michael Breyer signing off. Aaron, take us away. Get us out of here. You can go clean your basement.
Thank you, sir. My basement's clean. We're good. All right. Bye, everybody.
Stay safe. Oos.
Stay safe.
Bye, everybody.